that draws people together, and that's special. The topic that I would like to speak about this morning is one that was struck an interest in me as I was reading a devotional this past week, or maybe a little bit longer ago. It had to do with, it went like this. I can't remember exactly how it was stated, but the man who had the devotional spoke about, he said, he held up a note. This happens to be a 10-euro note that I have in front of you here. And he said that he is going to give that note to someone in the church that day. Now, my wife reminded me that this probably was given here some time ago. I don't remember when. But if I were to give this to any of you, would any of you raise your hands and say you would like to have this 10-euro note? If I were to say that, those who would like to have this 10-euro note, raise your hands. Oh, everybody raises their, nearly everybody raises their hands. Okay, now how do I decide who is going to get it? I guess the point I want to make is this 10-euro note has some worth. Now, how many of you would still raise your hands that you'd like to have this 10? Well, it's all crumpled up. And it really, what if I had a bit of mud and I would take this and I'd dip it into, well, let's say I can dip it into, maybe I want to drink this later, so I won't dip it in there. But if I were to dip it in some mud and then bring it out and hold it up like this, how many of you would still raise your hands and you'd say, yes, you would be willing to take this 10-euro note? I wonder why. I know that being a shopkeeper has already changed my idea of what money is all about. Sometimes the idea of filthy lucre actually is quite graphic, because I have gotten, one time I got a 10-euro note in, it smelled so bad, I didn't even put it in the till. I took it home, and I washed it. I put it on the outside and set it on the windowsill to let it dry and let it get to smelling better. Now, the worth of that note didn't change just because it smelled bad. It didn't change because it looked bad. It didn't change because it was all crumpled. It was still worth the same. By the way, that 10-euro note that I left on the windowsill, I forgot about it. A day or so later, I was walking out through, and the wind had taken it and carried it around and put it beside the house. And, oh, so I picked it up, and I got it out, and I said, well, it doesn't smell as bad as it did before, and I went ahead and used it, and I was able to buy something with that 10-euro note. I had exchanged that for another one. It wasn't, I didn't actually take it out of the till. Now, having said all of that, I'd like for you to think with me, what is the worth of you as people? What is the worth of a soul? That's the title of the message today. What is the worth of a soul? Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, there's a verse that says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, and the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils a breath of life, and man became a living soul. The word soul has to do with a breathing being. Man became a living soul. if we go on into the scriptures, we find that God's dealings with man as people has to do with the fact that he cared about this creation that he had made. He intensely cared about that creation, and he watched to see what happened to his creation. I've been reading through the beginning in the Old Testament, and I have more than one reading that I read. I don't just stay in the Old Testament, but after Noah. I'm actually up into Genesis chapter, 28 or 9 right now. And I've gone through the places where it talks about man sinned and got to the point where it was sin so bad that God looked at the earth and he said, it's an awful place to live. And he's literally destroyed the whole earth. He literally wiped the mankind as it was then from the face of the earth. That's what it says. And started over with Noah and three sons. And there were seven souls altogether who still lived. God cared about his creation, and he still cares about his creation. So as you go through the Bible, you come to a place where there's a man who lived about 3,000 years ago, wrote these words, Psalm 139, verse 13. He said, "For thou hast possessed my reins. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb." David is speaking about God and what God did. He says, "I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well." There is something inside David that knew that God had created him and that there was something special about him. And he was looking around and saying, "My substance, what I'm made of, was not hid from thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them." Now, it is hard sometimes to define who we are. But I think that we all, when we realize that we are worth something, it makes a difference how we look at people around us and how we look at ourselves. George MacDonald, who lived some time ago, wrote, "You do not have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body, but you are a soul." Martin Luther King, we did not have mail this past Monday. I believe it was Monday. Yeah, this past Monday back in the States, in the United States. I went to the mailbox and there was no mail there. And it was because it was Martin Luther King Day. He said, "I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man, his present nature, makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him." The isness we are, the isness of man. He said, "I refuse to believe that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him." There is something that is, man is worth something. He goes on to say, "I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him." He is saying that your life is worth something. His life was worth something. People didn't like what Martin Luther King was saying. He was saying that black people and white people and red people and yellow people and all people are worth the same, and that we need to recognize that worth. Whether you agree with how he went about getting his message across is irrelevant to this discussion this morning. But what he was saying, I believe, is he was lifting up the idea that man is worth something. Our souls are worth something. Job, many years ago, said, "What is man that thou shouldest magnify him, and that thou shouldest set thine heart upon him?" He is speaking to God. What is man that thou, God, shouldest magnify him, and that thou shouldest set thine heart upon him? He also said in Job 15, verse 14, "What is man that he should be clean, and he which is born of a woman, that he should be righteous?" Job was dealing with why God even cared about him. Here he was a very rich man. He was taken to the point where he had hardly anything, and he was asking a lot of questions. Why am I hurting? Why is all this sorrow happening to me? And at the end, his mouth was closed, and he said, "I give you honor. I give you praise. I give you glory." David, in Psalm 8, verse 4, again says similar thing. "What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him?" Psalm 144, verse 3, "Lord, what is man that thou takest knowledge of him, or the son of man that thou makest account of him?" And then in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6, Paul, or whoever wrote the book of Hebrews, says, "But one in a certain place testified, saying, What is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him?" How does it happen that we are who we are? How does it happen that we are here together and each of us understands that we each have worth? That what is the worth of a soul? I'm not going to say that I can even explain all of this, but if we leave this place and you have been caused to think about the worth of a soul, and when you look at people around you and you realize that each of those people have worth, have a reason for living, you can give hope, you can give help, you can give peace, you can give something to that. We can give it to each other, and hopefully we can give glory to God. As a living soul, mankind is able to see and notice his surroundings. I'm speaking about something that I heard from Ravi Zacharias. He says, "We are able to marvel at the beauty of a sunset. We enjoy and delight in children. There is a designed order to things. We as people can wonder at creation and what it is. We can look at a sunset and we can appreciate a sunset. And what it is, we can appreciate creation, what it is, but the creation does not turn around and look at us and wonder. Do you think the sunset looks at us and wonders who we are? Not really. It's not that way. God has placed in us the ability to perceive, to understand, to look at something and have. Where did that appreciation come from? Not only that, we also have a disappreciation for things that are ugly. We don't like. Why do we have likes and dislikes? I believe it's because we have something of the stamp of God in us. We are made a living soul. And God has created us in that way. We have intrinsic worth in just being who we are. Our existence has worth not only because of who we are, but also because of what others are to us. Do other people mean something to you? Henry, does Becky mean something to you? Of course. And, you know, people mean something to each other. And I think that's right. That's the way it should be. And we should care about people. Yesterday morning, I was minding the till at the shop. And the papers, people would buy the paper and they'd say, "Wasn't that a tragedy?" And it was a very, very sad happening that took place in Ireland in the last few days. There's a woman who was a very distraught woman. Somehow she took the life of three of her children, and somehow she did not value the souls of her children the way she should have. I don't know what happened, but it shook up the people that came into the shop yesterday morning to the point where, wasn't that a tragedy? And I think we should take note and recognize that it's because people realize that those children have worth. That woman has worth. There is something of meaning to life, and we should consider life precious and sacred. And if we do that, we will start asking some questions. And I believe that if we ask honest questions, God will answer us with good, honest answers. As souls that have worth, we also have responsibility. Responsibility to God and responsibility to man. What we do makes a difference in the world. There was a man who came to Jesus and he said, "How should I live? What is the most important commandment in the Old Testament? What is the most important commandment?" So what would you say is the most important thing? Moses reduced man's responsibility, I'm told, to 613 commandments. Now, he also reduced it to 10 basic ones that we often think about. But Moses said 613. It is said that Isaiah reduced those commandments to 15. I didn't do the study myself. It is said that David reduced them to 11, Micah to 3. "He hath showed you, O man, what is good, but what does the Lord require of you? To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Those three is what Micah said. But Jesus, when he was asked, what is the most important commandment? He said, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is likened to this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Two things of responsibility that we have. Because God is worth something, and he has given us worth. And so that means it's not just me, but it's me and my neighbors. And so I should give worth to my neighbors, and I should care about my neighbors, and I should care about what is going on in each of your lives. And I believe fully that you do care about what's happening in our lives, because you tell us that. And that's worth something, because we mean something to each other. Jesus said the second commandment is like unto the first. Later he answered with tremendous wisdom when they tested him with the question of the question was, should we pay taxes to Caesar? Now, they were trying to test Jesus. Wouldn't it be nice if Jesus would have just said, "No, you don't need to pay taxes to Caesar"? Then along comes April 15th in America, when we all pay our taxes, and we could very comfortably rebel, and we could say, "No, I'm not going to pay taxes to Caesar." We could also take the consequences. But Jesus did not say that. He said, "Give to Caesar those things which are Caesar's, and to God the things which are God's." He did a very interesting thing. He said, "Bring me a little coin. Whose image is on that coin?" Well, whose image was on the coin? Caesar's. So you give to Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and you give to God the things that belong to God. So now, if we're to give the coin that has Caesar's picture on it back to God, then, or back to Caesar, whose image do you bear? So who deserves your honor, respect? Who deserves to be given life to, back to? God. God deserves to have you give your life back to him and give him honor and give him praise and give him glory and give him the rightful place that he is as the creator. Because God has created us in his image and we believe he is good, therefore we have the utmost respect for our fellow human beings who are also created in his image with value far beyond anything we can pay for. What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Did you ever think about the worth of a soul? Matthew 16 and Mark 8 both ask that question. What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? I'd like to come around back around a little bit. A song that was sung many times over this Christmas season has the title of O Holy Night. And it goes like this: O Holy Night, the stars are brightly shining. And then it says, long lay the world in sin and error pining. So looking at the whole world as we're looking at the world, and we see that the world was laying in sin and it was laying in error. Romans chapter 3 verse 9 says, what then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have before proved both Jews and Gentiles that they are all under sin. In other words, we all have, as people of worth, we have done things that are not worthy of who God made us. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. And many times people go through their life without even thinking about God, without even realizing that we have a responsibility to God. We had a lady come to our house on Thursday evening, was it, Karen? Thursday or Friday evening? Friday evening. It's the night of Kenny's farewell. And she was asking questions. She said, for 73 years, I never really thought much about God. She didn't say I didn't think much about God. She said, I didn't ask these questions. But she is asking some hard questions. Why? What about my son? Where is he? He took his own life a year ago, and she's going through a very hard time. But she's now asking questions about the meaning of life, and she's asking questions about, well, what about my life in the future? And by God's grace, we want to give her the right answers and how she can be to have a relationship with God, how she can be comfortable in knowing that God is big enough to take care of her. He's big enough to have even saved her son at the end if necessary. I don't know, and I'm glad that we don't know, because we could be having tremendous emotional uncertainty if we would not be willing to just say, put things in God's hand, say, God, you are big enough. You're big enough to take care of that person. You're big enough to take care of this problem. Because sometimes, she told us that she was asking the parish priest some questions. And finally he said to her, he said her name, he said, look, I'm not God, and I can't answer all of your questions. And that was satisfying to her. And I think a lot of times we think that we need to answer all of the questions that people have. But sometimes the best answer is, I'm not God, but God can answer your question. God can give you peace, even in not knowing the answers. Does that make sense? I believe it makes full sense. So long lay the world in sin and error pining. The whole creation, Romans 8:22, groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And then in 1 Corinthians 1:17, okay, if you think about the world is laying in sin and error. And if you look around, the world is laying in sin and error, pining. The word pining means to desire something that is better than what we have now. There's an interest in having something that's an unfulfilled interest. And then 1 Corinthians 1, chapter 17, we're going to read a few verses here. For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? When you think about the sin and the error so many times lies in the wisdom of the world being totally wrong. It's error. It's wrong. Where is the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It's not by our own wisdom that we get to know God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, the Greeks seek after wisdom, but Paul says we preach Christ crucified. It's the fact that Jesus came to this earth as a soul, as a person, as a breathing person. Jesus took upon himself flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. He says, we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. So, long lay the world in sin and error pining. The next words, till he appeared. And the soul, what? Felt its worth. Till he appeared, and the soul felt its worth. John 1:9. Jesus, that was the true light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him. And the world knew him not. But as many as received him, and this morning is another opportunity that we have to again receive Jesus into our lives. I need to take that opportunity every day. I don't know if you do, but I think we all need to take the opportunity that we're given every day to receive Jesus into our hearts. We might think it's a one-time happening, but Jesus said, follow me. That tells me it is a walk. It is a daily thing that we need to do. As many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born, not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. When grace becomes uncoupled with truth, both truth and grace become weak and powerless. But we need to have grace and truth together, with grace and truth walking together as Jesus embodied. He could forgive that woman. He could speak to the woman at the well. He could do that because he was full of both grace and truth. He spoke truth to that woman. He spoke truth to the people around him. But he also spoke grace. The prodigal son came back to a father who coupled both grace and truth with each other. Truth alone would not have acknowledged the repentance. Grace was able to acknowledge the son's repentance and give forgiveness. I'd like to go to the strange and fascinating story of O Holy Night in closing here. The strange and fascinating sight of the strange and fascinating story of the song O Holy Night began in France, yet eventually made its way around the world. This seemingly simple song, inspired by a request from a clergyman, would not only become one of the most beloved anthems of all time, it would mark a technological revolution that would forever change the way people were introduced to music. In 1847, now that was the year in Ireland, one of the years that the famine was the hardest. In 1847, Placide Capot, that's a French name, and I don't know if I've pronounced it right, but he was a wine merchant who was known more for his poetry than for his church attendance. He was probably shocked to be asked by the parish priest to pen a poem for Christmas Mass, which was coming up in 3 weeks. Incidentally, he had only one hand due to a childhood accident in which his right hand was fatally damaged. I think it was shot off by a careless handling of a gun by one of his friends. If you see a picture of him, you'll see his right hand empty. He's not there. Regardless of what he thought of the surprising request, the poet chose to share his talents and write the poem. He was not really a religious man, but he took the book of Luke and he studied Jesus and he came up with this poem. In a dusty coach traveling down a bumpy road to France's capital city, the story goes, Placide Capot, consider the priest's request. Using the Gospel of Luke as his guide, Capot imagined witnessing the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. Thoughts of being present on the blessed night inspired him. By the time he arrived in Paris, Cantique de Noël, which is the French name for O Holy Night, had been completed. Moved by his own work, Capot decided that this was not just a poem, it was a song in need of a master musician's hand. Not musically inclined himself, the poet turned to one of his friends, Adolphe Charles Adams, for help. Adams' talent and fame had brought requests to write work for orchestras and ballets all over the world. As a man of Jewish ancestry, the words of this poem represented a day he didn't celebrate, and a man he did not view as a son of God. Nevertheless, Adams quickly went to work and wrote the music to compose beautiful words. Adams' finished work pleased both the poet and the priest, and the song was performed just 3 weeks later at a midnight mass on Christmas Eve. As the story goes, the song was wholeheartedly accepted by the church in France. But when Placide Capot walked away from the church and became a part of the socialist movement in France, the church leaders discovered that Adolphe Adams was a Jew. The song, which had quickly grown to be one of the most beloved Christmas songs in France, was suddenly and uniformly denounced and deemed as unfit for church services. But the French people continued to sing it in private, and a decade later, a reclusive American writer brought it to a whole new audience halfway around the world. Not only this, did this American writer, John Sullivan Dwight, who happened to be a Unitarian minister, which is another anomaly. He felt that this wonderful Christmas song needed to be introduced to America. He saw something else in the song that moved him beyond the story of the birth of Christ. As an abolitionist, he strongly identified with the lines of the third verse. Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. So he took that as a message for America at the time. Story does not end there. Many years later, on Christmas Eve, 1906, Reginald Fessenden did something long thought impossible. Using a new type of generator, Fessenden spoke into a microphone, and for the first time, a man's voice was broadcast over the airwaves. And it came to pass, he read a verse, and it came to pass in those days there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. He began in a clear, strong voice. After finishing his recitation of the birth of Christ, Fessenden picked up his violin and played, "They Say, O Holy Night, the Stars Are Brightly Shining," the first song ever sent through the air via radio waves. What I would like to bring to your attention again is this idea that long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared, Jesus appeared, and the soul felt its worth. And I believe that this morning, if you sense that you are worth something and that God cares about you, it will change the way you conduct your life on an everyday basis, on an everyday manner. Thank you for listening. I took more time than I thought I was going to. Let us kneel for prayer.